providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Cortland Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. We are continuing on with the weekend edition of the KE Report. I hope everybody enjoyed those first two segments with Richard Postma, diving into mostly the precious metals, but then we also did touch on some of the market moves in these final two segments. We are touching base again with Peter Buchvar, Chief Investment Officer at Bleakley Financial Group, also editor of the Book Report website. I'll post a link to Peter's website, and that's where Peter recaps on a daily basis the key data points that have come out, any important moves in a wide range of sectors for markets, and also any key news that he wants to recap, all with kind of a big picture outlook for markets and for the economy. Peter, I want to start kind of in the big picture sense here. Look, we've just had a just over four month rally in almost every asset class. Data, at least financial or economic data, continues to be generally weak, but it's not exactly in crashing territory either. We keep seeing a bit of mixed data, still on the generally downside, and we're through a lot of earnings season, and earnings season again has been generally weak with weak forward guidance. Peter, your big picture outlook for the economy and markets then, please.
Well, the two biggest things that hurt markets in 2022 were, of course, the sharp rise in inflation and the very aggressive Fed and other central banks. So now inflation is rolling over and the Fed's likely almost done raising interest rates, even though maybe they'll throw in one or two left. And that was all the markets needed to see a rebound. Because they thought, okay, well, the two things that were giving me a sore back are sort of relieving themselves. And that explains this. But I think we got a reminder that even if the Fed's almost done raising, they're still going to be raising, particularly after the very strong January jobs report. We've gotten a lot of tough talk from ECB members that said, we're going to keep on going, 50 more in March, maybe 50 in May. We're doing QT, even though it's modest. Reserve Bank of Australia said they may keep on going. So after a steady decline in interest rates that helped to charge up the stock market, interest rates now are reversing higher. And like, voila, the stock market is slowing down and beginning to sell off. So I think that there's still this very tight interconnection between the market's idea of which way the Fed is going and whether they want to buy or sell stocks. Meanwhile, in the background, getting to the economic part of this, the economy is, I think, basically contracting. You look at housing, we know we're in a recession. Manufacturing is essentially in a recession. Real personal spending in the U.S. declined in November, December. And for sure, earnings trajectory is going down. So you can argue that Q4 was the beginning of an earnings recession. Now, that is sort of getting less coverage in terms of the market's behavior because it's all focused on SAS with the Fed, but that's also going on here. And even let's just say the Fed is done raising interest rates today, I think people still have to get accustomed to the level of rates that are going to stay high for a while. And that the belief that, okay, after raising, economy slows, the Fed's just going to cut right back down again. Maybe they do cut, but we're not going from 5% to 1 or 5% to 0, maybe we go from 5% to 4. So it's this higher for longer interest rate environment, I think, that people have to get used to. And that in itself is its own form of constant tightening because of many, many years of very low rates. And all of a sudden you get high rates within a year. You know, any debt that's coming due that needs to be repaid, that needs to get refinanced, is going to be done at a much higher rate than the rate on the loan that's maturing.
Well, Peter, when you put these pieces together like that, you know, we do see so much weakness, as you mentioned, in the housing market and manufacturing with the consumer. But we've also seen that stronger than expected jobs report and the better than expected manufacturing report, which was not a stellar report. It just was better than expected. And so there's a lot of narratives running in financial media about a soft landing and that maybe the Fed has threaded the needle. And your point about rates staying longer for higher is the same point the Fed has made. They don't actually know the effects of what is going to happen because it's a lagging factor, sometimes 6 months to 12 months lagging factor. So are we out of the woods yet? Is it going to be a soft landing? Or do you think that we haven't really seen the pain of these higher rates for longer yet?
Well, it's more than just whether it's going to be a soft or hard landing, because you also have to extrapolate it one step further. Is okay, if it's a soft landing, well, what kind of recovery is going to follow a soft landing? Maybe it's just going to be a soft recovery. So is that good? Is it good that there's a soft landing but a soft recovery, or is it better if you get a sharp recession but then a very sharp snapback? So people are very simplistic in this debate. You know, Japan had a soft landing after their bubble burst, but you know, it ended up leading to a, you know, multi-decade malaise in economic activity. I'm not saying that that's happening in the U.S. I'm just saying that it's not necessarily good that's a soft landing and bad if it's a harder one. I think either way, you know, economic growth has slowed dramatically. 2022 in the U.S., we saw real growth of 1%. Now, granted, that was off a sharp snapback in 2021 after the 2020 weakness, but you know, that wasn't much growth. And I'll argue that we'll get negative growth or decline in growth in 2023. Now, let's just say it's only down 1% GDP for all of 2023. And when all said and done, is that a mild recession? Yeah, I guess so. But it's still not very good. It's still going to lead what I think is going to be a more pronounced recession in earnings. And if we go from a minus 1% economy to maybe in 2024, going back to maybe plus 1%, well, is that good? Is that any good either? Because we only had a soft landing. So I think you got to dig deeper into this debate. I think also it's too early to say what kind of landing we're going to have anyway, because the direction of the capital markets, the direction of the stock market will also determine the extent of the recession. Let's just say right now we're having, you know, a modest contraction. But all of a sudden, as the year progresses, the S&P 500 goes to 3,000, let's just say. Well, just that market action would lead to a pronounced decline in retail spending at the higher end. And that can then turn a soft landing into a hard one. So calls that people are making, I'm even hearing people say there's no landing. So we're going to have the most aggressive monetary tightening in 40 years, and we're going to have no landing. I mean, to me, that's just total nonsense. But you know, that's where we've devolved into, because everyone's looking at the labor market to think, well, the labor market's strong, how can we have a recession, without understanding the history since World War II, that recessions usually begin at very low levels of the unemployment rate.
Now, Peter, weren't we stuck in kind of a slow growth environment from 2010 through to pretty much 2020, right before COVID? I just remember everybody complaining that growth is slow, capital spending is slow for businesses, but the market still did well, given we were in the environment where we just saw lower and lower interest rates.
Right. So we have the slowest post-recession recovery since World War II in that decade. But you had zero rates and a lot of QE that helped to lift stock markets around the world, and well, mostly in the U.S., actually. And that separated the stock market from the underlying economy. And then the help of low interest expense, a corporate tax cut, and modest labor costs. And, you know, voila, you have a sharp widening of profit margins.
Well, Peter, it seems like another theme that ties in with the interest rates rising and falling has been the U.S. dollar. A lot of that is based on central bank policy, but just recently we saw the ECB do some things to tank the euro again, and that gave the dollar a boost. It seems like the fourth quarter rally that we saw in most sectors that continued into January was predicated not just on rates falling, but also on the U.S. dollar turning over pretty hard. Now the dollar's bounced right along with rates. What's your outlook on the currencies, and is this a new uptrend for the dollar?
Well, I see that very intertwined. I mean, the dollar topped out when the Fed started to slow down the pace of their rate increases. It was all coincident, and that was also in response to the slowdown in inflation. So that all came together at once. But now you have the uptick in rates, and you see a bounce in the dollar. So it's just showing you that the dollar really is just following interest rates right now, as it did in 2022. And you really can't, at least now, separate the two.
So in terms of markets then, Peter, it seems like a lot of markets are just trading hand in hand with each other. When the dollar's up, when rates are up, everything seems to be dropping. Do you see this coming to an end, or is this just the environment that we are in where if markets drop, well, don't expect really anything else to buck that trend?
Well, we're here for now. I think at some point the dollar, you know, could start to really trade off the rising U.S. debts and deficits, the record trade deficit, the record budget deficit in dollar terms, and a very high one relative to GDP of right now 5% going into a recession, and that the dollar at some point can weaken and maybe stocks and bonds weaken too at the same time. You know, that's a potential scenario that no one seems to think is possible. Everyone just assumes the dollar goes down, that eases financial conditions, and everything's fine for the economy and the stock market. But what happens if the dollar weakens because money is actually leaving the country for more opportunistic things elsewhere? What happens if the Bank of Japan gets out of yield curve control or widens it a lot, and all of a sudden Japanese bonds and assets become attractive and the yen rallies against the dollar because of that? You know, what happens if the European economy really rebounds because China's reopening? Well, maybe that can lend a bid to the euro. So it's not going to be as easy as we've seen in terms of the relationships over the past couple of years. It might, but I just think that we should sort of imagine other possibilities as well.
Well, Peter, another thing that the dollar and rates affect is some of the things that are near and dear to our hearts on the show, the precious metals and the commodity sector. Generally, higher rates and a higher dollar are a headwind to commodities and to precious metals. Generally, falling rates and falling dollar are a boon and a tailwind. Do you think that that will break down a little bit too? Because they don't always have to be inversely related. It could be that, especially on the precious metal side, it could be that gold and the dollar trend up or down together. What's your outlook there as far as how the precious metals relate to the interest rates and the dollar?
Well, it is interesting. In 2022, you had this ferocious rally in the dollar and a vertical rise in interest rates, and gold was almost flat. To me, that was a pretty stellar relative performance. But you're right, over a longer period of time, certainly gold is going to trade off real rates in the direction of the dollar. I think, to my point on interest rates, I think the Fed is almost done raising rates. And that is why the dollar has definitely topped out, notwithstanding, you know, the recent bounce that we've seen. And that should lend some support to gold. I think if the U.S. economy continues to weaken, which I think it will, then people are going to start to think about, okay, well, maybe by the end of the year, Fed's going to be cutting rates. Well, that's going to be dollar negative as well. And inflation, while it's definitely going to go lower from here, and maybe we'll get a two handle at some point in the third or fourth quarter, I don't think it's going to stay there. And it tells me that you're still going to have real rates that are going to be no better than zero. And gold should benefit in that kind of environment.
So carry that down to the gold stocks then, Peter. We've seen another combination of majors, or a major swallowing up another major. It looks like it's going down that road. But even as gold did pretty well last year, the stocks got crushed. Again, they followed the market. Do you see that correlation breaking?
I mean, I think, you know, at this point with the mining stocks is, while they're definitely going to benefit from rising prices just as they get hurt for falling, is we all know how difficult the mining business is. And, you know, you're talking about over the past couple of decades, how it's been, you've been much better off owning the physical than the mining companies, just because it's just such a tough business. And, you know, there's an extraordinary level of frustration in owning mining stocks and having to deal with just all the headaches of that business. And whether it's finding enough people, whether it's finding lower grade stuff or rising oil prices, making your cost structure go up. I mean, I know I'm talking, preaching to the choir here, but we know how difficult it is. Now, at some point, I do think you get a nice run in gold, and, you know, those margins, a lot of these miners are going to fatten up again. These stocks are going to have an incredible rise. It's just, and look, we've had a nice rise in the gold stocks over the past 3 months, call it. And so we've had a nice run. I do think they have a lot higher to go, but, you know, there's a lot of scarring out there for people owning mining stocks relative to the physical.
Yeah, almost like a PTSD situation where people are so damaged from the last 2.5 years of corrective moves that even when we've seen a rally for 3 or 4 months, sentiment's still not that encouraging in the space. Let's carry it over into another sector that was very topical last year, still very topical this year, and that's energy, Peter. We've seen oil go from 120 last year at the high, bounce down into the low 70s. It's up around 80 now, kind of holding firm in that 75 to 80 range. But nat gas has been the one that's really caught people's attention. They don't call it a widow maker for nothing because it's fallen from 9, almost 10, down to 250 now. What do you make of the energy space?
Yeah, natural gas fall has been quite astonishing considering you'd think that we'd had every reason for it to go much higher. But, of course, the weather has been incredible this winter, and at least in the U.S., and I can't speak to where you guys are, but I know certainly in the Northeast, it's been a pretty mild winter. Today, it's going to be almost 60 degrees outside, and Europe has been pretty blessed with a modest winter. So I think we can definitely point to that as being the suppressant on natural gas prices. I think crude oil, and you know, I've been pretty bullish on crude oil and the energy stocks for the last couple of years, 2.5 years now, that I still think that, and now you have the benefit to that is the China reopening. And while the China reopening will take some time to sort of play out and people sort of getting acclimated to life again, and that I think oil prices have potential to go much higher because the supply side is still very challenged.
Do you see governments or markets even more so warming up to energy companies, these older school energy companies, rather than the focus on more the green energy that we had over the last 5-10 years?
Well, the government has no interest in you know, well, most of these governments are, you know, all ESG adherents. So I don't think that they have much interest. They have interest in lowering the price of oil and gasoline, but they don't have any interest in actually supporting the companies that produce it. From an investor standpoint, in the S&P 500, energy stocks are still only about 4%. So investors, even with the tremendous rally we've seen, maybe 5%, the tremendous rally you've seen, there's still an underappreciation, I believe, for these companies. That's why I think they probably still go much higher.
Well, let's look at the green energy that Corey brought up there. Now, there's a lot of initiatives in place for electric vehicles, for the electrification, you know, charging stations. There's a lot of initiatives for renewable energy. So whether it's wind turbines or solar panels, there's going to be a lot of raw materials needed to fund that. And we have seen big moves in lithium, like actually very big moves in lithium and the lithium stocks, as well as a little bit of moves in uranium for energy generation, but not so much the copper, the nickel, a lot of the other components. What's your outlook on the critical mineral space, the focus that's being put on it from policymakers, and do you expect to see some big moves from Dr. Copper in the year to come?
So the longer term case for copper is certainly very positive from the demand side, and supply side still tough to get this stuff out of the ground and takes a long time to develop a new mine. So I think that there's definitely an upward bias for the industrial metals. I think, you know, the cross currents though are how the China reopening plays out. China's still dealing with distress in residential real estate. So there's going to be certainly a big slowing in new construction there, even though they'll probably, they're going to spend a lot of money in finishing existing projects. So to get people that have paid for their apartments to get them, get it to them. But, you know, the U.S. housing market slowing down, Canada, New Zealand, Australia, Sweden, all these housing markets are slowing down, and new home construction uses a lot of copper. So in a economic slowdown in some key parts of the world, you know, that's going to be, at least over the next year, the offset to the reopening of China and the demand for copper and other of these raw materials for EVs and renewable energy. So in the short term, I'm less confident about where the prices of these metals go. Bigger picture, 2, 3, 4, 5 years, I think it's clear that they'll probably go higher.
And you've brought up China a few times. Does a lot of this hinge on China getting through what undoubtedly will be kind of a shaky reopening, but then kind of moving past COVID?
Yeah, I mean, each week, each month that goes by, you know, that reopening becomes more more natural, and they'll be reopened like the rest of us. And I don't think they're going to, you know, I'm sure there is some scarring after 3 years of lockdowns, but a lot of people there still want to make up for lost time. And they did. They lost 3 years, many people. And they want to get that back. So their reopening, I don't think, should be treated that much different than how the rest of the world reopened. And by the second quarter into the third quarter, outside of, again, their real estate situation being challenged, I think their economy is going to be in a much better situation.
Even broadening the scope out a little further, Peter, we often focus on the West. We focus on the U.S. and Canada. We focus on Europe. And we focused on a lot of developed nations. We look at China reopening. But there's been a lot more banter in the marketplace over the last few months about emerging markets and something that has been ignored and really done terrible over the last, let's say, few years. What's your outlook on emerging markets and some of the countries that maybe aren't swept up in the huge central bank process? And is there any room to run in the emerging markets?
I'm pretty bullish on them. I think the China reopening is going to positively impact a lot of these emerging economies and markets. And not just that, the China reopening is going to help the entire Asian region. It's going to help many parts of Europe where countries there do a lot of business with China. I mean, if you're Japan, if you're Singapore, if you're Indonesia, China's your biggest customer. And having China reopen is huge. Germany, for them, China's their biggest customer. That's huge for them. Now, obviously, Germany's not an emerging market, but to my point, Brazil, Argentina, if you get more people going out for dinner in China, chances are Argentina and Brazil are going to be selling a lot more food and nutrients and crops to China. So it's a beneficial impact, I believe, in a lot of emerging markets. And one of the other reasons why they have the potential for outperforming U.S. markets is, you know, we know U.S. markets for the past 10 plus years have been dominated by big cap tech. I think the days of big cap tech dominance in the U.S. is over, therefore giving other markets a chance to play catch up.
What plays catch up? What do you think takes the leadership role then? Because there's always something out there that's leading markets.
I don't know. That's always a tough answer. I'd say leadership right now is just going to be emerging markets and international markets themselves rather than trying to figure out a particular sector. I mean, energy has been the leading market over the past year, and maybe that just continues.
Well, Peter, one more kind of wild card question here is everybody's looking forward to not just the Fed, but many central banks wrapping up their tightening cycles. And most of the central banks have messaged they want to wait and be data dependent and see what effect all this has had, because it's kind of unprecedented what's happened just over 2022 as far as the rate of increase of interest rates and just the amount of tightening that's gone on. Is it possible that when these central banks all pause, that instead of things just trending sideways, that there could be a sugar rally where a lot of markets just take off because the markets are pretty forward looking and may anticipate that? They're already anticipating that, but is that a possibility?
We already had it. That was called the month of January. That was the sugar high when you had a stock like Bed Bath & Beyond, whose bonds are trading at 6 cents in the dollar, go from $1 and change to almost five, even though they told you they were basically going out of business. We had, that's what January was. Tesla stock doubled. Now, granted, it was after a 75% decline, but we had the, oh, inflation's rolling over, the Fed's done raising interest rates rally in January.
Yeah, that's very true there, Peter. It was actually a four-month rally that we had. But I guess to Shad's point and to when central banks actually do pause, they keep on telling the market that kind of the worst is behind us for interest rate hikes. Do you believe that? Or do you think there is a possibility here that we could get one, let's say, 50 basis point hike?
No, the Fed will raise one more in March, and maybe they'll throw in one after that. But the ECB, who just raised 50, few weeks ago, they said they're going to go another 50 and maybe another 50 after that. So, you know, Canada took a pause, but Australia's after raising, so they're going to raise again. So there's still more hiking, it seems, that central bankers want to do, even though in the aggregate, it's sort of the tail end. But I think, again, the key is not how many more they have left. It's how long rates are going to stay high.
Well, Peter, if we are maybe in a longer bear market where this was just a relief rally inside of that over the last few months and things do roll back over, what will you be looking for data wise or what kind of indicators will catch your eye to kind of give you an idea that the worst of it is behind us? What will you be watching in the marketplace?
Certainly the level of inflation in terms of what the sustainable trend will be after we get this downside on inflation, you know, not where it bottoms out, but where does it settle out at? Now, we may not know that until 2024. For markets, it could just be a valuation thing. where things just get so cheap that you feel like it's discounted a lot of bad news. I think economically speaking, I think it's a good thing that interest rates are hopefully maybe going to stay at or above the rate of inflation. That's a good thing over time, but there's still a painful transition period going through that, again, because we've been an economy that's been addicted to artificially low interest rates, and going from that addiction to something more normal takes some time and some pain. So I'm just going to acknowledge that this is just going to take some time, and there may not be major events here. This just could be sort of a higher rate environment that chips away at cash flows because more cash flow is being allocated to interest expense rather than other things. And that we just need to be patient and realize that we're just not going to go to the heady days of pre-COVID. You know, those days are over. They're not coming back. Anybody thinks that we're going back to zero rates and QE and 1-2% inflation, and it was this monetary fantasy land that we all sort of feasted on, that's over.
Peter, I think this is a great spot to end it. Thank you, as always, for your time. Look, it's such a different market environment that we are living in and living through right now. And that needs to be noted. You drove that home right there with your final answer. Everybody, thanks for tuning in on this weekend show. Peter, great having you on the show. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend. We'll touch base again soon.
Sounds good. Thank you.